This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University nursing professor Cindy Kerber says the public seems to be adopting video screen medical consulting just fine.
People are very comfortable with FaceTime and Skype, so I think that it's part of the culture to be more acceptant of telepsychiatry.
GLT's Mary Cullen has more on mental health help via the small screen. Plus, the Me Too era is having one adverse effect. It's chilling the climate for men mentoring women in the workplace. John Norton has a quick tutorial in the music of Masaki Bato during What's on Your Turntable, and Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington drops by. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Nowadays, you can video chat with your doctor from your kitchen, on a phone, tablet, or computer. What that usually means is faster access to care. For psychiatric clients, that can mean access to care in an area where psychiatric appointments are hard to come by. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Illinois State University Mennonite College of Nursing Professor Cindy Kerber about how telehealth is changing the field of mental health care.
So McLean County has a deficit of psychiatrists, and they're not alone. In part due to a nationwide deficit, telemedicine is growing more popular as a method to get psychiatric care. So what does a telehealth appointment look like?
Telemedicine is the delivery of medical services, assessment, and treatment via video conferencing. So a telehealth appointment would look like something similar to FaceTime or Skype, only the video conferencing platform is HIPAA compliant. So what that means that it would be confidential for both the provider and the patient.
And so when going to a telehealth appointment, is that something that you have in your home? Is that something that you have to go to a doctor's office for?
There's a variety of ways that that could be set up depending upon the clinic or agency. So sometimes patients can access it from their home. In addition, the provider could also be at home. And that creates some nice benefits for both in that you don't have to travel. So if the provider is seeing patients in a variety of different clinics or locations, they don't have to drive to and from. In addition, it might be a nice benefit for the client to participate in telepsych from their home, both because of not needing to travel to the clinic or wait in the waiting room for the appointment, but it provides some anonymity if they're worried about stigma. And also, if the person has anxiety related to leaving the house, then being treated in your home would be a plus.
So basically, a client is sitting in front of a computer-like screen with video capabilities and essentially video chatting with a doctor who then assesses and determines the appropriate care for their needs. So you, as the client, can see your doctor's face, but that's still pretty distant connection when mental health appointments cover dense topics. So how is it possible for the doctor to build rapport and form a connection with their client over a screen?
Well, the provider, which could be a physician or a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, does have the capabilities through video conferencing of both seeing and hearing. And, you know, of course, with being able to visualize, you have both the audio or both the verbal and the nonverbal communication. So rapport is established in that way, very similar to face-to-face. Many of the over 50% of the United States counties have no mental health professional. So this is a great advantage to increase access to care. That said, there is some studies that are talking about effectiveness, and one study asked veterans about their preference about video conferencing, and actually two-thirds had no problem at all with video conferencing, but one-third of the population said they, if possible, they would rather see someone face-to-face. With the culture shift to more computerized technology, people are very comfortable with FaceTime and Skype, so I think that it's part of the culture to be more acceptant of telepsychiatry.
So when it comes to a psychiatrist who is providing care via telehealth, how is it that they can be sure that they are, reading is the term here, reading their client properly and accurately diagnosing them when you can't be there face-to-face? You know, you can see a wound on someone's arm and know, oh, yeah, you know, there's something wrong with you. But when it comes to mental health, that's all on the inside. And if the person isn't upfront with their feelings, sometimes it takes a while to understand what the underlying issues are.
What we found research so far is indicating that video conferencing is very effective. I agree that it's probably nicer to be face-to-face, both for patient preference and for the provider preference, but in cases when that's not possible, video conferencing is a really wonderful option. Given the shortage of providers, it provides a nice opportunity for people that might not have received care otherwise.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen talking with Cindy Kerber, a professor of psychiatric and mental health care in ISU's Mennonite College of Nursing. A major priority when it comes to mental health care is building that rapport we discussed earlier. It often takes a few sessions before a client is even willing to be vulnerable. So when it comes to telehealth, do clients always have the same doctor, or is it something that it's rotating based on who's available?
I think that would depend on the client and the services, but the relationship is usually very consistent, and they try to keep a consistent nurse-patient or physician-patient relationship.
So you mentioned that nurse-patient relationship. Can we get into the nurse's role when it comes to providing this care?
Sure. Both registered nurses and advanced practice nurses or nurse practitioners would be or could be involved in telepsych. In fact, if the patient is in a clinic where there's 24-hour nurses, the nurse would provide an additional assessment. The nurse and the client together might share that assessment with the nurse practitioner or the physician, and then the video conferencing would follow. And then certainly that collaboration that includes the patient, the nurse, and the nurse practitioner is very helpful in continuity of care. On the other hand, if the patient is accessing video conferencing from home, then there would have to be a different mechanism for communicating with other healthcare providers on the healthcare team.
When it comes to needing a prescription, how would that work? If a person's at home, they don't really have access to prescribing their own medication. So then who is typically in charge of or responsible for prescribing?
So the provider, if a prescription is warranted, would just call that into the local pharmacy.
And then who would be in charge of following up on the medication in the sense of making sure that it's the right medication, the right dosage, having the correct effects that the prescriber had hoped for?
So maybe a follow-up appointment with the provider through telepsych would occur a week or two later to assess for effectiveness, any concerns, any side effects. And certainly the patient would have access to the provider or the provider's office through phone or email or online programs such as MyChart.
So now we discussed it at the beginning of this interview that there's a nationwide deficit of psychiatrists. How does the introduction of telehealth address that deficit?
Well, it provides an opportunity for providers to get to remote locations without the travel time.
That was GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Cindy Kerber, psychiatric care professor in the Mennonite College of Nursing at Illinois State University.
Support for GLT comes from Coffee Hound, offering a mindful approach to craft roasted coffee with freshly poured cups at three cafes in Uptown Normal, downtown Bloomington, and at the Foundry in Bloomington. Plus, take-home bags of fresh roasted coffee from Sirius Roasters. Info at coffeehound.cafe. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a report on trauma therapy. The Bloomington City Council is giving grocery chain Kroger another year to complete infrastructure improvements in the Bloomington site where it had previously planned to build a $25.4 million store. And it's also signed off on a new commission to help the city make technology decisions. Here in studio to talk about those decisions and more is Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Mayor Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks again, Charlie. It's great to be here.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular council meetings. Aldermen last night approved creation of a new technology commission, which will advise city staff on everything from automation to energy efficiency and even public Wi-Fi. What did you think of this idea?
I think this is long overdue. I think Alderman Matthew deserves a great deal of credit for this. This is something that we've, amongst many of the council members, talked about for a long time, and some of the staff. There seemed to be some resistance in some quarters, but I'm very happy that we're moving ahead with this. And in fact, I had discussions this morning about some possible appointees to that committee so that we can really begin to get the ball rolling.
So how will the seven members of the Technology Commission be chosen and appointed?
Pretty much in the way that I choose other commission members, except obviously this one you'd have to have a specific background, I would assume, you know, to be on this. So I would take recommendations. Sometimes people may just out of the blue apply. Sometimes I will make some phone calls to encourage people to apply. I'm sure Alderman Matthew has some people he'd like to have. Other members of the council may submit names, and then I'll take a look at them and vet them and try to come up with a list of seven. Sure. And then they would be, usually they're straddled, that is, so an entire commission doesn't come up at once. So we might have four up in 1 year and three up in another year.
So what kinds of areas do you hope they cover? What waterfront do you want them to? Is it going to be an IT network person, a Wi-Fi person, a marriage of the Internet of Things and administrative operations kind of person? What are you
maybe I need to have you come and consult me, because I think those are some very, very good ideas right there. Well clearly we want the areas that you have mentioned, you know, a broad, you know, spectrum of areas dealing with IT. And so this isn't just, you know, I think this morning with a couple conversations I've had, people are misunderstanding. This isn't just we're looking to develop a couple new apps for service delivery. I mean, that might come out of this, but that's not really. We're thinking about this in I think a broader, comprehensive approach. So yes, the seven people would need to have seven different types of background, and then that doesn't necessarily mean that you know, we might not have two or three that have some of the same expertise. It just means the broader scope of responsibilities are what we need to keep in sight.
What do you hope they tackle first?
Wow. Everything. you know, we've got lots of areas that we need to improve. We need to improve our IT, which is, you know, something that a lot of members of our council have talked about and many members of the public for a long term. I would say my guess is, in fact, I'd love to attend the first meeting or two just to see what the members of the commission begin to talk about. I don't know that there's a single thing that I can really point to, though, Charlie.
The city has a lot of commissions: historic preservation, beautification, transportation, public safety, and community relations, just to name a few. As you add new ones like technology, will any others be going away? Does the city still need them all?
Well, that's actually a very good question. We were always talking about those. At this point, there are nearly 300 people who serve on boards and commissions. And because of our rule that we've established that says you cannot serve on more than one commission at a time, that we established about 5 years ago, then that plus term limits does mean that there's going to be a fair amount of turnover. I think it also means that the people who serve on the boards and commissions, there's no question, are much more representative of the community today. Now, the question about specific boards and commissions, one that we will very likely, and I support getting, in a sense, getting rid of, is the Police and Fire Commission. And many of the people who have served on the Police and Fire Commission have said, you know, it's almost like training wheels on a tricycle. We don't really have an effective role. It was really the police officers and others, or the police administration, excuse me, as well as the human resources who wind up making the decisions and offers. And they're in the room, and they feel as if their role is not a substantial one. So if that's the case, and there is difficulty in getting people to serve because they feel like they really don't have substantial responsibilities, then why have the commission?
Any other similar watering trough beautification or cleanliness commissions?
No, we don't have cleanliness, but Beautification would be the closest thing. No, we've got lots of different boards and commissions. I think at this point, we did consolidate quite a few of the building boards, also a few months after I came in as mayor, in addition to putting in term limits and many other changes. That doesn't mean that we're not open to more changes as we move forward.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mayor Renner, lawmakers in Springfield are now debating whether to raise the minimum wage in Illinois to $15 an hour by 2025. Already, it's gone through the Senate. Up next in the House, it's at a key committee this week in the House. The governor wants it to happen. What would this mean to the city of Bloomington from an operations standpoint?
I think comparatively little, partly because if it's phased in over 6 years, most of the people that work for the city who are permanent employees, the overwhelming majority, are earning roughly close to $15 an hour even now. Not all. There are some that are seasonal, and I don't mean just lifeguards. You know, your proverbial 18 to 20-year-olds who are working as lifeguards. But even people who are supporting their families. Not too many years ago, when I spoke to several people, there were a couple of gentlemen who had families, and they were supporting them with less than $11 an hour in terms of their salary. That's just appalling. That is no longer the case, but they're still not going to be at $15. I strongly support the statewide minimum wage. Us getting to that point by 2025 should be a no-brainer. I mean, at this point, we have to afford something of that nature. Yeah. We can hardly expect people to deliver services to citizens in our community and not be able to afford to live in the community that they're serving.
Any idea what it might cost the city?
I don't know. That's just my guess is once it's we'll probably have a staff analysis shortly after it passes, and my guess is that, again, when you're talking about something that far out, the dollar an hour for the very few employees that it would cover is going to be very minimal compared to the kinds of issues that we'll deal with on a daily basis. Frankly, from having like a 75-degree temperature shift and the danger in potholes, I think that is very likely to wind up having cost us much more money than this entire program.
Let's pivot to pensions. Yesterday, Governor Pritzker appointed leaders of the new Pension Consolidation Feasibility Task Force. It will look at an idea that has floated around for years to consolidate some of the state's 671 separate public pension funds. That would impact cities like Bloomington, which have their own police and fire pensions. What do you think of pension system consolidation?
Well, I would say at 1,000 feet, it sounds like it's a good idea. In our particular situation, usually police and fire pensions are the ones that are the most difficult. We've had a plan in place. In fact, we got a statewide award for our plan. We had a plan that was passed in late 2013. It was one of the things that I ran on. I said we need to have. And a few months later, we actually had a plan for funding it. So we've got earmarked revenues for police and fire. And again, we got in 2014 a statewide award for it. So regardless of what happens or how they're consolidated, Bloomington is... It doesn't mean we don't have challenges, but we're in pretty good shape. Relatively to Illinois, we're probably in excellent shape with respect to funding our police and fire pensions.
GLT has interviewed the presidents of the Normal and Bloomington Police Pension Boards. They're opposed to consolidation. They worry about the loss of local control. And, of course, the argument that they raise is the state itself doesn't have a sterling track record on pensions. Have you talked to them about the concerns? Do you share that one?
I have not. No.
Do you share that concern about if you give it to the state or a
well, if we're giving it to the state, but we have an obligation within the city, within our contracts, and I think my understanding through our legal representative's interpretation of the Constitution is that you cannot diminish pensions, and I would assume that one of the things that we might ask for, if that were to be the case, we would ask for an exception. Leave us alone is one of the things that I would say. And that is, we will be fine if you just leave us alone. There may be other communities that would benefit from the consolidation. In Bloomington's case, again, I don't know that it's true, but at this point, we're grappling with it, and we have been grappling with it for years.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner, joining us as he does after most council meetings. Let's pivot. Let's go back to a technology issue again, a technology and transportation issue. The town of Normal is looking at an e-scooter program, similar to the ones that you see around the streets in St. Louis or Portland, or D.C. has one as well. Washington, D.C. has an e-scooter where you stick a credit card in, it's electric, and you have an app, and you just go afterwards. And then you drop it off and push end ride, and you're done, and you just leave it there. Is that something Bloomington would also entertain, or is Bloomington fundamentally different than Normal in the way that it's likely to be used?
Sure, it would be different from Normal, of course. We don't, Normal's 55,000 plus population, about 20,000 are students, and its shape and things are different. So certainly the usage would be different, but in terms of interest, absolutely. If Normal were to actually pursue this, I would love to get involved with an intergovernmental agreement so that we share that, similar, to the way we share other things.
One of the aspects of this technology that the town of Normal is finding interesting is the ability to geofence these scooters. So you can say you're not going to drop them off anywhere but within this specific geographic area, say downtown or uptown, as it may be. you can ride it anywhere, but to stop paying your money, you're going to have to drop it off in a certain place. What would be good places for use in Bloomington?
Well, obviously, our downtown and the areas between downtown, perhaps some key areas along Constitution Trail. And as we expand Constitution Trail and our perhaps our bike lanes, presumably people might use those. We might even extend it out to some areas like Greentop Grocery, perhaps even Eastland Mall. I don't know what those would be, but obviously we would want to have staff entertain what the most likely options would be. We would want to try to connect to at least a couple of stops on our west side. West side tends to be neglected in not just this type, but many other types of services that we deliver. So we would want to be sure that was not the case here.
One of the things that is becoming clear is that these little micro conveyances, e-scooters, electric skateboards, electric assist bicycles, are all coming whether cities are ready for them or not. What does Bloomington need to do to get ready for these and to put a framework in place so that people remain safe and still get to use these things that they're going to be using no matter what?
Well, I'm on the Transportation Committee of the U.S. Conference, the National U.S. Conference of Mayors, and that's one of the questions I asked this past summer, not specifically with respect to what you've mentioned, but I said, as we're changing, we're having potentially driverless cars and many other things, the nature of transportation in the 21st century city, the latter part of the 21st century, will very likely be very different, perhaps fundamentally different, from the 20th century or even the early 21st century. What kinds of changes in terms of planning should we do? And the people who are the so-called experts, I guess you'd say, in this area said, just keep planning the way you've been doing it. We will accommodate the nature of the city that you have. Just be mindful that you need multimodal. You want to make sure that you are thinking about mass transit. You're thinking about pedestrians. You're thinking about bike lanes or other types of vehicles in addition to automobiles. And so whether or not automobiles are driverless or whether or not we have someone riding particular different types of vehicles, perhaps on our bike lanes or on our bike trails, that we will be able to accommodate that. Are we poised at this moment? No, but certainly this is something that is on the minds of our transportation planners, as well as elected officials, myself included, and the city manager.
We've heard from sources on the Planning Commission that there is some frustration that city staff aren't taking some concerns to heart about zoning density requirements for neighborhoods. Current zoning allows 70 units per acre adjacent to the downtown, both east side and west of the downtown. Those objecting, including some in the Dimmitt's Grove neighborhood and the neighborhoods just west of the downtown as well, say that could actually hurt development in downtown because it's easier and cheaper to buy land near downtown than in downtown and build a multi-unit. This could affect the character of neighborhoods as well. It's unclear whether the two-year effort on the zoning revamp that's scheduled to go to the Planning Commission on Wednesday has enough support to pass. First, do you think that the city staff are taking the concerns of the Planning Commission seriously enough?
Well, again, I don't know the details of how the city staff have been interacting with the people in the neighborhoods, but if they have particular concerns, and the concerns that you've mentioned are ones that have got to be serious, have got to be addressed. And that's why ultimately city staff does not pass a zoning plan. It is elected officials, the people that you've elected to the council, and then the mayor. The mayor has a veto if I thought that, or even a line item veto if I thought a particular portion of it was not appropriate.
So what's the temperature of the council then on that particular question?
That I don't know, because this is only that particular concern I haven't spoken to the council on yet.
Okay.
So, but we will make sure that we, as much as possible, take into account downtown development. I've been campaigning on downtown development, you know, since I first ran for mayor, and it is something on a daily basis that I'm committed to and concerned about. So I'm certainly not going to be supporting or signing any zoning law that might very well have a detrimental effect on downtown or some of the immediate areas or have a ripple effect.
Yeah, policy has a ripple effect no matter what you do to it. If you change it, do you impact something like the redevelopment of the former Coachman Motel site as well?
Right.
In an adverse way.
Right. Well, the former Coachman property that we did have and may very well have another, in fact, might would be the same developer that might come back, and that was an under 50 unit facility. And so if we're talking, you know, if we change it, if perhaps changing from 70 to 50 or 55 might alleviate some of the concerns and fears, that's a pretty easy change to make. Again, I don't know if that would alleviate the concerns of some of the residents of Dimmitt's Grove or what impact that might have, but it would certainly be a place for us to start to think about what the future of that zoning code might look like.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you, Charlie.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular council meetings. Next week, we'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Koos. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT, a public service of Illinois State University.
It's hard to get help when there are no helpers, and the consequences can be devastating, even deadly. Join us for the next GLT Conversation on Youth Mental Health, February 12th. Guests include Tom Barr with the Center for Human Services.
There aren't any child psychiatrists in McLean County.
Get a full understanding of the current state of mental health services for McLean County children and what happens when needs go unmet. Learn more about our next community conversation, February 12th at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Dr. Matt Fraker and his staff at the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center, protecting the human companion animal bond, caring for life of all kinds, and proud supporter of the Parklands Foundation. Details about Parklands Nature Preserves at 454-8606. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Last year, the Me Too movement held men in positions of power accountable, but the consequences have fallen on women yet again, as powerful men are shying away from mentoring women in the workplace. GLT's Mary Cullen talks with ISU's acting director of the Women and Gender Studies program, Kyle Ciani, and psychology chair Scott Jordan about the implications of this mindset and the importance of workplace mentorships.
It's very healthy in large corporations to have very formal mentorships. The statistics show that formalized structure eliminates the possibilities of harassment. I sort of chuckled when I, you know, was reading about it, because this has actually been going on for centuries. So as a women's historian, it's interesting to me to see how the Me Too movement has blown things up again. There's always something, there's always some social issue, a cultural concern that creates an environment where people, especially people in positions of power, become nervous. There have always been people in power who don't want to take certain individuals with little power under their wing. And so I don't see this as something that's new. I see it as something that is a new way of handling a very old issue.
In order for our listeners to understand a little bit more about what we're talking about, can we get into the specifics of the behavior that we're seeing in these relationships?
I think what's happening, especially with the concerns over sexual harassment, sexual assault, rape in the workplace by men in positions of power, CEOs, directors of movies, directors of huge corporations, right? And so there's this sense that if a man is alone with a woman in the workplace, providing what he thinks is mentorship and what she believes to be mentorship, and something goes awry, then there's going to be some sort of sexual harassment or sexual assault claim that is made by the woman against the man in power.
I don't deny that men are doing this. I don't see it in my life. I don't deny that men are doing it. And there's a plethora of other reactions that are occurring, or at least are being brought to light. For example, you know, I was mentored last week by a woman.
But what is happening with this, these claims by men in power, and I'll say a name, Mike Pence. Mike Pence has famously claimed that he's never in a room alone with a woman. That's not being a good mentor. It's, he doesn't know how to mentor. Mentorship is not about taking a woman out to lunch. That's not mentorship. That's a date.
Women only make up about 5% of CEOs in top Fortune 500 companies. So with men in the primary role there, and then they're the driving force, they have the economic force, they have the cultural force. What does that mean for the impact on business?
The viability of industry is going to decrease in the next 20 years, the less open they are to diversity and inclusion. I'm optimistic about the current puncturing of consciousness that's going on. I'm optimistic that this awareness can sustain itself. And so, long term, I think businesses that's their messaging, that somehow we're not going to mentor women because it's dangerous. If that's your company's message, you're not going to last as long as you think, right? So from that perspective,
I absolutely agree with that. Right? They're not going to last.
No. And they're going to regret the fact that they weren't more aware of what they said at that moment, right?
Right.
Say it's a media corporation, and then they're using that message and possibly unintentionally, possibly intentionally, spreading that message to the masses. So then what is the influence on the next level?
This is what we have to do. We have to understand that those are words they're saying, and we can say other words, and we can have other actions.
A feminist agenda has always been knowledge is power, right? The mantra, knowledge is power, knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. And as a historian of women's history, I like to take the long view of this, and I see how women have embraced that mantra, knowledge is power, from, you know, for centuries. It's incremental change, step by step by step. There's not going to be a huge groundswell in any cultural ideology. It takes not always centuries, but it takes a couple of generations for things to change.
So in this time when, whether it's realized or not, this mentality of concern when it comes to mentorship, how does a person seek out a mentor?
the AAUW, there's five key points that they note. And it's, first of all, you want to do your homework. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to know why you think you need a mentor. You don't want to waste that person's time, certainly. But you need to have an understanding and an idea of why am I seeking somebody out who's in my workplace. Mm-hmm. You absolutely want to ask questions. Thirdly, and I love this, it says be respectfully persistent. You need to have an understanding that, yes, your mentor might be busy, but you're important too. You know, your original question, how do you seek someone out? I think if there is someone who is in a job that you think you might want to aspire to, let's say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you send them an email. You like them on LinkedIn. You send them a LinkedIn email. Mm-hmm. You phone them. Imagine that. Actually picking up a phone and hearing a human voice at the other end. I guarantee you, if the mentor that you're seeking is someone who has been mentored, they will say yes. Fourthly, you have to be committed. This is as a mentee. And then the fifth thing that this AAUW list stipulates is you have to be patient. And that's something that I see a lot of mentees lack. They want their career to change overnight. And you have to understand that this is a long time coming, right? It's very rare that your life is going to change overnight. That happens in film. That happens in fantasy stories. That does not happen in real life. It just doesn't.
Be wary, very aware of what your own unconscious assumptions are. Just take a moment and figure out, why would I go see this person? Is it because I want to make the money they make? Because I want to have the power they have? Right? And know why you're going. And the reason that matters is that'll influence the type of questions you ask and what you tolerate as an answer.
Oh, I love that, what you tolerate as an answer. That is gold.
Oh, well, thank you very much. But my point is, what kind of answers are you expecting? And I think if you go in there looking at a Lego set, and what this person's going to do is give me the three Lego pieces I need, it's not going to work.
For the person who's listening and doesn't have a mentor or doesn't know when to seek a mentor, what does it mean to find somebody to guide you through? And how do you know when you should seek a mentor?
You should seek a mentor the day you get the job. I mean, really. I mean, if you're in a new job, whether that is at a convenience store or whether that is at a major corporation, you need to look around you on day one and figure out, who can I ask for help? Who is going to know about the company? Who is going to know about the culture? Who is going to understand when it's cool to do something or when it's not so cool, or what kind of training programs might I have? So day one, you need to look around for a mentor.
I would also just add to that, be aware that you are entering a small realm of uncertainty when you ask someone else for advice. I'm not saying that in any way to scare someone from approaching people, but I think there's just a certain degree of wisdom, dare I say, in why am I going to this person? And then what are the things that might make me not want to continue? Just to have a sense that, just to deal with the things that might surprise you if you're there. There's a small scale of vulnerability that's created when you say to someone, you know something, knowledge is power, mm-hmm. you know something mm-hmm. I don't, that means you have power, I don't, right? So recognize that, it's fine, because that's how it works, but recognize that there's, I'm gonna just say, a little bit of poker going on. It takes trust, it takes time, and I would say one step at a time, and make sure that it's successful, and then know what you will not tolerate.
That's GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Illinois State University Professor Scott Jordan and Kyle Ciani. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, what's on your turntable with John Norton? More than a quarter of people who are homeless have some sort of mental illness, and social workers and psychologists often connect that to traumatic experiences. A Springfield men's shelter is trying to address the problem with a trauma support group. IPR's Mary Hansen has more.
Keith Treadwell says it took a while for him to talk about the trauma he experienced.
I wouldn't say I was scared. I was uncomfortable and a little nervous.
The 46-year-old lives in Springfield and participates in Helping Hands' supportive housing program.
I went through their groups that they had. I took advantage of the help that they have there and got an apartment with a roommate. And life has been looking up ever since.
One offer of help is a weekly trauma-focused therapy group. Treadwell says he's struggled with a drug addiction and homelessness for years. He says at first he wasn't sure how the other men in the group would react to his story. But after he shared,
I felt a weight lifted. And up until that time, it had felt like I had been carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders.
The group aims to break the cycle of persistent homelessness, where men stay at the shelter, get help and find housing, only to end up back at the shelter months later.
Because of these cycles that happen, the cycle of addiction, the cycle of self-sabotage. Part of the reason that happens is because we're treating the branches and not the roots.
That's Megan Golden, the social worker with SIU Medicine who leads the group. The root cause, she says, is often trauma. That could be anything from an isolated incident, like losing your home in a natural disaster, or it could be events that played out over the course of several years, like child abuse. Golden says treating trauma is different from other therapeutic approaches that address anxiety or depression, because often the symptoms of trauma are different.
Flashbacks, nightmares, difficulty maintaining good relationships, hypervigilance where they're looking over their shoulder all the time. There's a lot of different ways I think trauma can affect people.
Usually about 10 shelter residents gather on Tuesday nights and sit in a circle. Golden will lead the discussion on relapse prevention, healthy relationships, or coping mechanisms. They've been meeting since April, and attendance is voluntary. But Kurt Everly, who's staying at Helping Hands, often convinces his friends or even newcomers to the shelter to come with him to the meetings. He says he tells them,
it might be useful if you have something on your mind. You know, you ain't gotta say anything about your past or anything. You know, just something that you have can just talk about.
Everly says he's found others who share his struggles and even picked up a new coping mechanism.
Me and another guy, we color a lot. Try to define our issues so we don't get so mad and angry so quick.
That's Mary Hansen of IPR. GLT will have a community conversation about youth mental health issues at 6 this evening at the Illinois State University Alumni Center. Join us to hear a panel of stakeholders who deal with mental health challenges among young people and listen for a broadcast of the show tomorrow during Sound Ideas. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker, a Japanese singer-songwriter-guitarist who shapeshifts among three different personas is getting extended turntable play at Reverberation Vinyl in Bloomington. GLT's John Norton stopped by the store this week to talk with owner John Anderson, who gave a quick tutorial on the music of Masaki Bato in this edition of GLT's What's on Your Turntable. He started with this song from his just-released Drag City Records album titled Nowhere.
Psych rock, Japanese style, here at Reverberation Vinyl, right across from Illinois Wesleyan on Main Street in Bloomington. When I hear psych rock, though, John, I think more psychedelic rock. This is more of a folk thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it goes both ways, really. In his earliest days, his first band he kind of came to prominence with was a band called Ghost in Japan, and formed in the mid-80s and came to prominence in the 90s. And a lot of the early stuff of theirs was more experimental and acid folk, like pretty way out, heavily influenced by Tom Rapp of Pearls Before Swine and that kind of stuff, which you can totally hear in this new music. And then as Ghost changed throughout the years and all the different projects he's had throughout the years, it became more, a little more rock styled. And his current band, The Silence, is definitely a rock band. But yeah, this is a little bit more of a return to the psych folky roots, which I normally don't like. And when it comes to a record that somebody says, oh, we're getting back to our roots, so we're going to recede to something that we used to do, that's usually a red flag that something's not good. But this is a fantastic record.
And we're listening to a brand new album, came out February 1st.
This is from the brand new record entitled Nowhere. And this is the first blush, my favorite song, Tower of Silence, Tower of the Silence.
Tower of the Silence. からたちは夜に白い壁と踏み朽ちる朝に身を結ぶ。
Nowhere is the album we're listening to. What's this track? You really dig this track.
Tower of the Silence is the one we're listening to. This was kind of the it's the second song on the record. It's like they always say, like the first, there's like the first one's there to grab you. The second song's the best on the album, and that might be true. It's my favorite, at least. Masaki Bito of Ghost, he was the lead vocalist, main songwriter, kind of lead guy in the band, and they put out a number of records starting in the early 90s up through the late 2000s on Drag City, and their sound changed from kind of what we had just heard with more of a folky, psych, acid folk thing early, and then went into more of a rock, psychedelic rock thing later, which kind of carries on to his current thing, The Silence, but as Ghost in the 90s and early 2000s, that's kind of how he became known. Here in the States, and definitely Drag City had a big role in that, being a well-known indie label here in the States. But really hard to choose one track but from Ghost, because they got a lot of records and a lot of favorites of mine, but this is Hazy Paradise from Hypnotic Underworld. This is one of my favorite records of theirs from 2004, and this is very representative of the later Ghost sound and leading into the current sound of The Silence. But this is Masaki Bito's Ghost with Hazy Paradise.
So we're listening to the band Ghost, which is Masaki Bito's one of three different incarnations he has, a solo artist with Ghost and with...
The Silence.
Okay. So we're listening to Ghost right now. What's the name of the song again?
The song is Hazy Paradise from the Hypnotic Underworld record, which is one of my all-time favorites.
Where are we going from here?
Let's jump around. He did some collaboration records with Helena Espal, who was a Swedish artist. She was in the band, still is in the band. They occasionally still perform. Espers, who's another favorite of mine, another Drag City band, but legendary kind of Philadelphia acid folk band from the early mid-2000s here in the States. But he did a couple duo records with her. I mean, she's a cellist by trade, and she'll do manipulated sound through the cello and lots of other small instruments, but they're beautiful records, and this particular one is both folky and drony. Overloaded Arc is the LP that I'm going to play, and the song is called Until Tomorrow. It's one of my. It's a long track, and it's a beautiful one. But they did two records together, one of which you can still get, which is Overloaded Arc. The other one's out of print now. But if you like Espers or you like anything you're hearing here, this is probably the most pure kind of expression of all of his different folk tendencies. It runs all the way from European classical music to Japanese folk music to the UK acid folk stuff of the 70s, and all that kind of stuff comes to bear in these records. But the song is Until Tomorrow from the Masaki Bito Helena Espal LP Overloaded Arc.
Hanging out with John Anderson at Reverberation Vinyl on Main Street in Bloomington, right across from Illinois Wesleyan University. Masaki Bito is who we're focusing on, but there are three different incarnations of Masaki.
Yeah, trying to make it as least confusing as I possibly can, but he was in a lot of different bands and did a lot of different records. And yeah, thematically, what you're going to hear, it all kind of sounds like the same guy. But I'm jumping around a little bit just because there's so many great records, it's really hard to choose just one.
So what we just heard was...
What we just heard was his duo record with Helena Espal. She of Espers, they did a record together called Overloaded Arc, and that song we heard is called Until Tomorrow. And now we're going to completely change gears into another project of his from the mid-90s called Cosmic Invention, which was kind of the beginning of the rock era, the more psychedelic rock era of Ghost. Some of the guys he met on this project ended up being members of Ghost on subsequent tours and whatnot. But this particular song, first time I heard it, it sounded to me like a sidelong electric Miles Davis track from 1971 or something. This record was just released on vinyl for the first time by Drag City last year, I think, in 2018. And if you are kind of a person that likes Acid Mother's Temple or the more rock side of Ghost but don't know this, or any Japanese psychedelic music from Flower Traveling Band, the Taj Mahal Travelers, like it's all kind of in here. But this is Misaki Bito's project from 1996 called Cosmic Invention, and the song is called Ryujin.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with John Anderson at Reverberation Vinyl. What's on your turntable? Misaki Bito is on that. He was part of Ghost. He was part of The Silence. And he's got a great new solo album out. It just came out February 1st.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful package, too. It's very unlike Drag City in a lot of ways. It has this cool plastic sleeve. It's on white vinyl. It's packaged unlike any other Drag City record I can think of. But
John's holding it in both hands. It is. Yeah. It's a really nice...
Yeah, it's a gorgeous record, but inside and out. But yeah, the production of it, it's definitely... his kind of idea was to make a very simple record with as few overdubs as possible, very rich acoustic guitar recorded to 2-inch tape, live takes, live vocal takes, very few overdubs. And there's a few on this record. This last song that we're going to hear is probably the most like Ghost or The Silence or the more rock stuff. It has, drums and bass and other things that aren't on some other tracks. But yeah, it's a very simple record, but very beautiful. And it's a good intro, too, if you're kind of just getting into it. It's not a bad place to start with him because it covers several of the bases that are kind of keystones of his career. This is another favorite from the latter, the tail end of the album, but it's, like I said, it's a little more full band sounding, but this is the track Sundown, which is another one of my favorites from the new record entitled Nowhere.
John Anderson of Reverberation Vinyl on Main Street in Bloomington, speaking with GLT's John Norton. Our thanks to Anderson for sharing the music playing on the turntable in his store. This is WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Thanks today to Mary Cullen and John Norton and to Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington for his time. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.